from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is the last day of September 2019, the 30th. It's a Monday, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We are going to be having Colin Mine come on. He often does on Monday mornings to fill us in on what's been going on in the VT digger world of Vermont in over the weekend and in previous days. And Colin will be joining us in just a moment. But first, I wanted to let you know what's upcoming later in the show. In the second half hour, we're going to be speaking with Lisa Holmes. She's a political science professor at the University of Vermont, and Lisa will be talking to us about the latest twists and turns out of Washington on all of this talk about impeachment, what is likely to unfold. Might be asking her a couple of questions about the underlying sort of systems and institutions we have for handling a wayward president. And that's going to be coming up in the second half hour. Later on, we're going to shift our attention to wildlife and wildlife corridors in particular. How do we get wildlife across the busy Route 100 corridor that runs in one stretch here in Vermont between Waterbury and Stowe? A lot of traffic on that road. And we have some local and statewide environmental groups joining to make sure that our wildlife, our furry friends, can get across the busy state highway there. And because there's a lot of great open forest land around Route 100, and the wildlife want to be able to get back and forth to different parts of it. So we'll be talking about that in the second hour. I think it'll be a very interesting conversation. Lots for me to learn, that is for sure, as there are so many topics here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And when we want to learn about statewide news in Vermont, a really excellent person to turn to is Colin Mine. He's the managing editor of vtdigger.org, and he is very kind to join us this morning on the telephone. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Dave.
And we have sort of some reverberation recently from the all the news out of Washington here in Vermont. And in one headline I saw, our governor became the first sitting Republican governor in the country to say that an impeachment inquiry is a good idea.
Yeah, at his weekly press conference, there were some news reports out early in the day Thursday saying that he was sort of out there as the first prominent sort of Republican official, which we define in our stories as sort of governors or members of Congress, to openly back the impeachment inquiry. And then at his press conference, he spoke at some length about it and explained that he didn't necessarily support the impeachment of Donald Trump per se, but felt like what he had heard was concerning enough that it merited an effort to get the facts and make a determination of how to move forward, so that he did support the process of an impeachment inquiry and trying to actually understand what happened here with this phone call between U.S. President Donald Trump and the Ukrainian president.
And that's interesting, I think, coming from Phil Scott, because he has been, since the beginning of the Trump ascendancy, candidacy even, and into the White House for the president, someone who has been not a big fan, I guess is one way to describe it, or just at least not automatically falling into line behind the president. And is this just more of the same, or do you think that really he's just responding day to day to discrete issues here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I think that I think he's being honest in how he feels about things. You know, I think he sincerely dislikes President Donald Trump and the effect that he's had on political discourse in America. I think that, you know, on a case-by-case basis, whether it's immigration or, you know, LGBT rights or, you know, whatever the issue of the day is, that he has fundamental disagreements with the president. And then I also think that that plays really well politically in Vermont. You know, he's quite a moderate Republican, you know, on social issues tends to be aligned more with the Democrats than with the more conservative wing of his party. And, you know, there's been a real rift between the sort of Phil Scott Republicans in Vermont and the Donald Trump Republicans, which are smaller in number, but happen to be leading the state Republican Party at the moment. That could change in a few months here. But, you know, certainly one of the defining sort of political, you know, through lines of Phil Scott's time in office has been his break with the Republican Party that has more and more fallen under the spell of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Phil Scott's recent utterances on this and his general stance regarding the president is not universally popular in Vermont. I want to get your sense of whether it works for him politically here or maybe a neutral thing or maybe a detriment to his reelection efforts, assuming he's running again for governor next year. Of course, Vermont governors run every 2 years. And I was just looking at he put up a post on his Facebook page about expanding and strengthening Vermont's workforce, you know, something you would think would be fairly unconnected with national politics and the whole entrapment matter. Yeah, impeachment matter. That was an interesting word, entrapment. Yikes. Here we go. Here's one response to his thing about workforce development. You should be ashamed of yourself for endorsing the impeachment of President Trump. I really hope you are voted out. Vermont would be better off. And there seems to be quite a thread here of people expressing similar sentiments. Is this a political fringe in Vermont? Is it, I don't know, Russian bots? Or what do you think's going on here?
I mean, I can tell you anecdotally through the comments that we get at VT Digger and particularly on our Facebook page that if Vermont's electorate reflected the general sentiment of political commenters on online communities or sort of message boards, then it would be a far more conservative state than it is when people actually go out to the ballot box. I mean, why it is that conservatives in Vermont seem to often dominate the conversation online is, you know, sort of beyond, I think that would require some sort of sociological study or something like that, whether it's that their voices are suppressed or they feel like their voices are suppressed in sort of more mainstream outlets and therefore feel like they have to speak up in that sort of forum. Hard to say, but when you look at the election results, I mean, you know, Phil Scott, you know, Keith Stern was his primary opponent the last time around, and, you know, for a fairly unknown grocery store owner from White River Junction, you know, had a decent performance. I think he got about a third of the votes or something like that. But I just don't think that Phil Scott is terribly concerned with losing a significant part of the Republican vote by taking these sort of stances. You know, he signed the gun bills a few years ago, and that was supposed to sort of, you know, perhaps cause a Republican blowback. And by the time the election came around, it seemed like, you know, not a whole lot of voters had held a grudge about that. So, you know, I just don't think Phil Scott and Jason Gibbs, his chief of staff and main political strategist, are terribly concerned about him losing a huge amount of the Republican vote, and they don't see anyone in the Republican Party who can really pose a challenge to him. And therefore, what's much more important for them is to get the sort of moderate Democrat and moderate Republican vote, and him sort of standing up to Donald Trump is very effective in sort of convincing people that he, you know, is aligned with them on many of these important social issues.
Yeah, no, I don't know that Phil Scott has ambitions to go to Washington. I've never actually asked him whether he'd like to serve in the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate. Certainly, it's a possibility because all three members of our congressional delegation are not getting any younger, if you know what I mean. And the governor is, I think, just right around 60 or maybe 59 or something like that. So he, you know, he clearly could be running for Congress or the U.S. Senate in the next couple of years or few years. And I'm just wondering, what would this stance look like in a U.S. senator or member of Congress from Vermont in Washington?
He'd catch holy hell from the Republican Party, that's for sure. I mean, you look at someone like Susan Collins from my home state of Maine, mm-hmm. You know, who's probably about as close to a Phil Scott Republican as you're going to find in the Senate right now. And, you know, when she's been on, you know, where she's sort of on the brink of, you know, do I support this, do I not, with the Kavanaugh hearings in particular, you know, the amount of pressure that's put on her from the National Republican Party is absolutely immense, and something that Phil Scott certainly does not have to deal with when making these sorts of decisions, you know, which are significant in a sort of moral and ethical sense, but not really in a political sense. You know, I mean, he's not going to tip the balance of power or anything like that. So, you know, how he'd act if he had that kind of pressure on him, certainly questionable. But, you know, I think most people sort of assume, or I don't know why, but that he's not sort of has ambitions of being a national political figure. But if you look at his sort of rhetoric around, you know, bringing civility back to politics, you know, it reaches well beyond the state of Vermont and really speaks to the sort of national divisions. And that's been his sort of calling card for the past couple of years, starting when he signed the gun bills. And, you know, that was sort of his refrain during his campaign. So it seems like that would graft pretty well onto sort of national political campaign, saying that he's going to help bring civility back to Washington as being sort of a, you know, common sense Republican.
You know, it actually, I mean, I think it would be quite something to see if for instance, he were to launch a candidacy for the, you know, Republican nomination for president. We've had Vermont governors do this before. It always seems like kind of a stretch from this tiny state, but Howard Dean did it and, you know, made the covers of Time and Newsweek and led in the polls in the Democratic primary back there in 2004 for a while. And so I just wonder whether the whether Phil Scott could actually sell on the national stage an idea of let's step back from the brink of you know, the word people attach to this presidency an awful lot is chaos.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, as Republicans, we have an opportunity here to reinstate maybe some level-headed management skills and a little bit of sanity and a little bit of civility and all that good stuff. And I don't know. I mean, it would be, again, quite a leap, but it also would be kind of fun to watch, I would think, for a lot of folks.
Yeah, I think I might have misspoke a bit there. I got a bit ahead of myself. But when I was talking about a national politician, I mean sort of whether he can make it to the Senate or the U.S. House.
Which
I don't think the Republican Party, I mean, who knows, there could be this sort of severe rubber band effect. But it's hard to imagine the sort of Trump's Republican Party in any way mobilizing behind, you know, one of these Phil Scotts or Charlie Bakers from Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Or Hogan from Maryland. You know, these sort of, they seem to be holding down the sort of moderate wing of the Republican Party, or even Mitt Romney or something like that. And it just, it would be hard to imagine the Republican Party in its current state sort of mobilizing behind a candidate like that.
It would be hard to imagine, but, you know, if I were a Mitt Romney or, you know, a Phil Scott or Larry Hogan or whoever, that would probably be my pitch. If I were, you know, say running in 24 and I was saying, I was out there saying, you know, listen, we need to kind of put the craziness away and start sobering up here a little bit, folks, and et cetera. But that's, I mean, we're getting pretty wildly speculative here. So, which I know, an editor of a mainstream news organization like VT Digger just loves to do. But no, I'm only kidding there. Hey, Colin, there are some other news items on the docket here in Vermont that we ought to probably mention as well. And one also involves the governor, who said kind of an interesting thing about vaping and a possible ban on the sale of flavored e-cigarettes in Vermont the other day. What is happening here?
Yeah, so a number of states around Vermont, I believe Massachusetts and Connecticut among them, have the governors have taken executive action to ban flavored vaping products. You know, the rationale being that they're really targeted at young people, at, you know, teenagers, especially some of these more teenagey flavors, you know, bubblegum and creamsicles and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there's really no reason, you know, the argument to have vaping products is that they're a smoking cessation device for people who are already addicted to cigarettes and that sort of thing, and that this sort of, you know, there's just no need for it from a public health standpoint. Phil Scott said that he's open to the conversation, as he usually is, but isn't going to be taking that kind of action himself, at least not immediately, and would prefer to have the conversation when legislators return to the State House come January. And we've spoken to a few of the key chairs of the Democratic chairs of the Health and Human Welfare Committee. committees, and it seems like they're definitely going to move fast on this kind of legislation. I don't think that an outright ban is likely to happen, you know, just eliminating vaping products altogether, but it certainly seems like some sort of flavored ban will probably move along quite quickly, and Phil Scott's indicating that he will sign it.
Yeah, one interesting thing here is a lot of the press I've been seeing on the national level about vaping indicates that there have been more of the cases where people have gotten ill from using THC vaping products as opposed to the nicotine vaping products. But the nicotine vaping industry seems to be taking a huge hit here. And I guess maybe the THC less so, partly because it's underground. What do you see there?
Yeah, I mean, I must say that I find the whole, this sort of, panic to be kind of mystifying. I mean, we've known that these devices were, you know, fairly unregulated, spreading really fast. There were some alarming studies in Vermont that sort of mirrored what's going on around the country, showing a really high percentage of teenagers had started vaping, which, of course, you know, begins these sort of nicotine addictions that can morph into cigarettes or, you know, sort of lifelong issues. So, I mean, certainly, and you know, Phil Scott has pointed out that Vermont has taken a number of actions in that sense. They banned the online sale of vaping products unless it's to licensed sort of, you know, wholesale buyers so that kids can't order them online. They raised the overall smoking age to 21, which also applies to vaping. And they increased the tax on vaping significantly, which is shown to deter young people more than older people. So, you know, Vermont has by no means been asleep at the wheel, as the governor said, but, you know, this sort of more significant step of banning certain types of products altogether. And, you know, why states have taken such drastic action? I mean, you know, I've been talking to my colleagues, like, we've known the cigarettes are killing hundreds of people a day for decades, and, you know, they're still legal. So I think that the speed at which people became ill, you know, the sort of thing where you check into a hospital and in some cases die within a few days has been really scary to people. But, you know, if we're really worried about smoking products killing people, then, you know, there's still lots of cigarettes on the shelves if anybody wishes to partake.
Yeah. Hey, let's go to a caller. Rama's on the line. Good morning, Rama. Rama, are you with us? Nope, guess not. Okay.
Am I here now?
Yeah, you are here now. Good morning, Rama.
Okay, somebody pushed the right button. I heard a...
So
anyway, I'm sorry to take you back a bit in your conversation here, but people seem to be kind of confused about the Republican Party and all of these scandals that are going on about it nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, unless you folks are willing to really dive into the history and get historical context to understand, this is today's Republican Party is not an aberration. It is part of the path that they have been on for decades now. And I would even go so far as to say the foreign interference in our elections and welcoming it, because we had Nixon back in, 68. Was going to the North Vietnamese behind our government's back to get them to help him with his election campaign. We had Reagan doing the same thing with the Iranians in 82 in the hostage situation, where he got them to hold back releasing the hostage until after the election. So, you know, this foreign interference to advantage the Republican Party in elections is not an aberration. It's historical. It's a tradition in their party. They've been doing it. And this is the same thing with the racism and the misogyny and the anti-environmentalism and the anti-peopleism and anti-labor. All of this stuff is historical in context. And if people try to review all of this in the context merely of Donald Trump, who is nothing more than a product of the Republican Party. The Republican Party is not a product of him. He is a product of where they've been going for decades.
Rama, I think your point is an interesting one. I mean, I do think that the Republicans need to start answering a question about the fact that if you go back over the last 50 years, we're talking about, you know, line up the presidents, Trump, Obama, Bush to Clinton, Bush 1, Reagan, Carter, Ford, and Nixon. Go back 50 years. It's a pretty good sample size, I'd say, from 1969 when Richard Nixon was inaugurated to I guess this goes up to last year, this chart that I'm looking at. And I haven't added up all the numbers yet, but you know, Trump criminal convictions of people connected with these administrations. As of a year ago or so, Trump so far 24, Obama 0, Bush 2, 16, Clinton 1, Bush 1, the first Bush had only one criminal conviction connected with his administration. Reagan had 16. Of course, you remember Iran-Contra and all that. Carter had
all the pardons.
Carter had 0. Ford had 1. Nixon 55. I added them up, and I don't have the sums in front of me right now, but at one point I added them up, and the totals were like something like 207 to 9 or something like that. Okay, if you had a basketball game in which the red team scored 207 points and the blue team scored 9 points, do you think you could conclude something from that?
Well, I think to rephrase your question, if you had a basketball game where the red team committed several hundred flagrant fouls and the blue team committed just a few, who do you think actually should be the better team?
That's another way to kind of describe the picture here.
I just throw that in because I think the coverage of Trump always misses the fact that this is historical for the Republican Party. It's been predictable. There have been people that have been saying this is right where they were going to go. Trump is, he's the political offspring of Sarah Palin, and she's the political offspring of the 1990s talk radio freakout phase of the Republican Party.
And Lee Atwater and really a lot of players going way back. Donald Segretti, you name it, there it is. Hey, Rama, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Colin, let me get your thoughts about that. What do you make of this incredible imbalance? If you go back over the last 50 years and you just count the criminal convictions of people connected with administrations of these two main flavors, Democrat and Republican, it's a real there's a huge imbalance there. What should people take from that, if anything?
Yeah, a lot to analyze there in your Rama's takes. I think that certainly, you know, if you look at Republican administrations past, the stats you put together, much more troubling on the Republican side there. I think in terms of sort of Trump being, you know, a historical sort of, that it was somewhat predictable, I think people, certainly the Republican Party, or at least part of it, has moved further and further to the right. I don't think that Donald Trump necessarily was something that any of us quite expected.
Interesting. Just a few minutes to go here, and I do want to pull the lens back into Vermont a little bit, because we were talking about vaping and our governor. Tell me about what this says about Phil Scott's political style, that he wants to wait for the legislature to weigh in here.
Never sort of being ahead on controversial issues. I mean, the most, I think, on things like guns other sort of, I think he's a libertarian at heart, you know, so anything that's sort of the state stepping in and saying this is the way it should be, I don't think he's very comfortable putting himself in that position if the political sort of winds are blowing in that direction. Unless he's sort of philosophically opposed to a particular issue, he's not going to step in the way necessarily. But certainly we've seen time and again him indicating an openness to the Democrats doing something and then either signing it or letting it pass into law when the time comes.
Hey, another topic. VT Digger had a very interesting story. I mean, in some ways, it's almost a little obvious, but on the other hand, I think it is a very worthwhile exercise every now and then to kind of gather up the data and say, let's really look at this picture, which is what happened in the case of this story that VT Digger had about teacher salaries in Vermont. And what did Digger find out here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of, you know, foundation of this story is the idea that, you know, Vermont is constitutionally required to provide an equal education to students around the state. And, you know, we knew that there are severe discrepancies in teacher salaries, because these are negotiated at a local level. So despite the fact that funding is sort of, you know, guaranteed around the state at comparable levels, or at least at a baseline level. Teacher salaries, you know, range from, in some places, you know, $40,000 is about the average salary. In South Burlington, it's up to $80,000. So we wanted to sort of look at how that discrepancy sort of looked like across the state, whether it's confirmed by data. Indeed, largely it is, although there's certainly some outliers. And I think we'll continue sort of pursuing a lot of the questions that were raised in this story, which is, do these salaries mean that things like teacher turnover or the licensing of teachers or school outcomes sort of have severe differences, and how deep does the sort of divide go?
Yeah, lots of open questions there for sure, and fodder for more work by your terrific education writer, Lola Dufour. I think that one factor here, of course, is different costs of living around the state. I mean, if you're teaching in Essex County, you're probably living in a less expensive house than if you're teaching in South Burlington. So that is one factor. I don't know that it explains all the discrepancies here, but just throw that in there. But hey, Colin, we are fast approaching the bottom of the hour here, and always an excellent discussion we have with you, and I really appreciate your participation. I will let you get on with your day there at BTD. Thanks very much.
Yeah, have a great one, Dan.
All righty. Hey, we're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news, and stay with us, folks. We're going to have an interesting conversation coming up with Lisa Holmes of the Political Science Department at the University of Vermont. She's going to be talking to us about the ups and downs, ins and outs of impeachment.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV-FM and AM.
And we are back rolling into the second half hour of our program on this Monday morning, September the 30th, 2019. Thanks for staying with us, folks. Lisa Holmes is an associate professor of political science at the University of Vermont. She's been a guest previously on the Dave Graham Show here. And one of her areas of expertise is in judicial politics and the blending of where politics begins or ends, and where the justice system begins or ends, and the front line between the two. And boy, we have some of that going on recently in the good old U.S. of A., don't we? And Lisa Holmes joins me on the phone from the UVM campus in Burlington. Thanks very much for doing so.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And there's many, many twists and turns in this impeachment thing, and we could probably go for hours. We only have about 25 minutes. But I wanted to ask you, first off, the president is out this morning with a tweet accusing Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, of treason.
Yeah.
And is this treason?
No, it's not treason. Although, of course, this is something that the president has touched on with respect to the whistleblower as well. You know, referring to a whistleblower as being a de facto spy in a situation like this, and hearkening back to the days when treason was handled, very seriously. So, yeah, no, this is not treason.
You know, one of the things that bothers me about this, there's a real, I think, theme here. And it is manifesting itself in so many different aspects of the Trump presidency, and that is his deep, deep confusion about about his interests and his person and the national interest. I mean, if you think about it, all of his critics are quote unquote enemies of the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that there's a philosophical statement made there. I think if you study fascism, that's part, one of the legs of fascism is this idea that the leader becomes the state, and the state and the leader are inseparable, right?
Right. Well, and also just sort of the idea of using the power of your office, using governmental power to conduct your own kind of personal vendettas, you know, to go after the people that you perceive as enemies. There is something definitely different going on here. You know, one thing I think that's interesting about this is that one of the most classic quotes from, for example, the Federalist Papers was this idea of ambition being used to counter ambition, that Madison and the rest recognized that our political leaders were not going to be perfect. So let's channel that imperfection so that people are looking in government to police each other through checks and balances. But the kind of key thing I think that's missing in the examples that you're talking about, Dave, is that Madison talked about how the person's self-interest had to be tied to the office that they were holding, not just their sort of naked personal ambition, separate from their office, separate from the good of the country.
Yeah, this manifests itself itself in so many ways. I mean, including making a phone call to a foreign country with which the United States has some serious foreign policy business to conduct, right? And that's Ukraine, which is under attack by Russia, and then basically talking about how we're going to manage foreign policy of the United States in a way that is essentially geared toward back to the individual, Donald J. Trump,
right,
and his personal interests. And again, I just think that he's constitutionally, maybe that's, or unconstitutionally is a better word, unable to separate his own being with that of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do see many examples of this. And I actually remember last time I spoke with you, you mentioned that too, because I think we spoke, you know, one of the things we talked about last winter was the firing of Jeff Sessions, or asking Jeff Sessions to leave in replacement by Bill Barr. And I remember saying at the time, well, you know, Jeff Sessions is everything that Trump could want in an attorney general. And you said, and you were right about this, that actually he might be sort of a perfect attorney general for a conservative Republican president, but that's not what Trump wants in an attorney general. You know, he wants an attorney general that's going to provide him some sort of cover. So replacing Sessions with Barr is, I think, another example of this, of replacing somebody who in every other way looked like a perfect person for that office for a conservative Republican president. But the president was looking for somebody who would provide him some cover from the Mueller report, and now perhaps with what's going on here. And it's not a big surprise to me that President Trump seems a lot happier with Barr as his attorney general than Sessions.
We have a caller on the line. Let's go to Ziggy in Newport. Good morning, Ziggy.
Good morning. Lisa, I'd like to ask you just two quick questions. When Adam Schiff did his parody, I guess, he called it a parody, on the testimony there that they did, I think, on Thursday.
Right.
Does that go on record as word for word as what he said?
Well, yeah. I mean, that the transcript would reflect what he said.
So there's a transcript. Okay, so I'm an analog man living in a digital world, but if I went on a thing and I read the things of the testimony of that hearing and all the statements that were made, so I would think that was a fact.
Okay.
I mean, I could. Anyway, and another one. As far as the proper procedure for Congress, when Nancy Pelosi came out on at the end of last week, and she said it's going to be a formal inquiry into impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
Does Congress have to vote on an inquiry, or do they just have to vote on impeachment?
Right. Okay. So you've got two different questions there. I'm going to handle the second one first. So it's about procedure. There is no set procedure on how impeachments occur in the House and then the trial in the Senate in the Constitution. The one time that the U.S. Supreme Court has weighed in on this, it dealt with Senate procedures in an impeachment trial for a federal judge. And what the U.S. Supreme Court said was that the Senate has the sole power to try impeachments, which means they get to decide within some outer boundaries of ridiculousness, so long as they don't do something like flip a coin as their trial, it's up to the Senate to decide. So what you're referencing, Ziggy, are the votes that the House held in the previous impeachment inquiries. But there's nothing in the Constitution that says just because they've done it that way in the past means they have to do it this way now.
What are your feelings about Schiff doing what he did?
Right.
I mean, he looked, he appeared like he was reading the transcript, and it was like watching SNL.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm a little ambivalent about that because I think Well, yes, and for the following reasons. One reason I don't think it's necessarily the wisest choice for Schiff to have made is the fact that Americans like you, Ziggy, might have a problem with that. But on the other side, an important thing to keep in mind is that, like it or not, impeachment is more of a political thing than a legal thing. And so one thing that Nancy Pelosi, for example, has said about this current situation is that this phone call with the president of Ukraine is a kind of a simpler, more discreet, you know, situation that's easier for people to wrap their heads around than all the stuff in the Mueller report. That's not a principled statement. That's a political statement. And so to bring this back to what Schiff did, on the other hand, he made a calculation, I'm presuming, that this was the way he wanted to present this to the American public.
So can Mitch McConnell have an opt-out if he decides not to take it to the Senate and have a vote on impeachment in the Senate if Congress never vote, if the House never voted on impeachment on the inquiry?
Well, I'm a little confused about your question. You know, the Senate does not get to pick up with this unless and until
they
the House passes one or more articles of impeachment. And presumably that's the direction the House is going in, although we don't know for sure. But if and when the House passes articles of impeachment, then, of course, the ball is in Mitch McConnell's court. And again, he can kind of handle this sort of however he likes. It could be a quick thing. Now, one wrinkle on the Senate side is that the Chief Justice presides over the impeachment trial if it involves the president. Although, as William Rehnquist said last time in the Clinton impeachment trial, that he relied a lot on Senate procedure and the Senate parliamentarian to help him work through the procedures. So I guess on that point, I might pull back on the comment I was beginning to make just a touch, that Mitch McConnell has sort of sole authority here because the Chief Justice would have some involvement. But, you know, Mitch McConnell chooses to frame this, to portray it, and even some of the procedures that he tries to put in place, he would certainly have some authority over doing that.
Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call, Ziggy. Hey, Lisa, I wanted to also just ask you about the Mueller inquiry and maybe some of the differences between what we're seeing now. I mean, you mentioned that it's simpler and it's easier for people to grasp and it kind of ties up more neatly in a pretty package, I guess, is
right.
one way to describe it. I think one of the real problems with the Mueller report is that, you know, he produced a lot of understandable facts and a lot of material, and maybe the problem was it was overwhelming. There was just too much of it. But, I mean, it's easier to get your head around a nine-page inspector general or a nine-page whistleblower complaint than it is a 440-something page prosecutor
sure.
summation, right?
Yes.
So just in terms of, you have some experience assigning readings, I gather.
Do
your students prefer nine pages or 440-something?
Well, I guess it depends on the nine pages, right?
Yeah, sure. I know I'm sort of half or even three-quarters kidding here. But but I think a key problem with the Mueller investigation and the way it sort of played out is this Office of Legal Counsel memo that says a sitting president cannot be prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Mueller investigation essentially ended in a whimper. I mean, first of all, his personality, you have a very mild guy who doesn't want to, he's like allergic to making a splash, okay?
Right.
And then the second aspect of this thing is he's in a situation where he basically can't make a splash.
Right.
And Is the OLC memo the key problem with the Mueller report?
I don't think it's the only problem. I mean, and I'm not even sure, you know, I think other people would not even classify it as a problem, right? You know,
yeah.
Obviously, whether you think of that as a problem or not depends a little bit on where you sit. It's definitely relevant to the Mueller report and the impact it made or lack thereof. But I would say that it's only one. You know, another thing, as you noted, was that the special counsel investigations have a tendency to be very long, to be very detailed, to be almost overwhelming with an almost overwhelming amount of information. And the point that I also just made kind of buried in there of about how long all of that took also, I think, had a big impact on how this played out politically, because this was something that we had been living with for a long time, which also, frankly, gave the president an opportunity to talk about it, to try to discredit it, to, you know, complain about it for many, many months, which meant that sort of the sides were already drawn. The sides were already taken by the time that the Mueller report landed. So I think there's a lot to kind of what you're saying about the impact or lack thereof on the Mueller report to sort of the political health of the Trump presidency. But the OLC memo was only one part of that broader story. And another thing I would also point out is that keep in mind that, you know, how many people have been indicted, you know, because of this? How many people pled guilty because of the Mueller investigation? That it's not as though it had no impact. It's just that if all you're looking at is the question of is President Trump still president or not, you know, the Mueller report alone was not going to be able to take care of that.
Yeah, that is true. In fact, one of the indictments and convictions resulting from the Mueller investigation was that of Paul Manafort,
right,
who had been very active in the Ukraine, of all places.
Yeah, exactly.
And some of my conservative friends are trying to liken this letter that Senators Leahy, Menendez, and Durbin wrote last year to the chief prosecutor in the Ukraine, saying that essentially, please don't interfere with the Mueller investigation. They're basically saying that, look, the Democrats are doing it too. They're saying, help us out in getting after our political opponents here, please, Ukraine. One key difference there is that if you just look at the facts of the matter, Paul Manafort currently, as far as I know, is incarcerated in the federal correctional system.
As far as I know, too.
Hunter Biden is not.
Right.
So maybe there's a difference, a key difference there. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think there are a number of key differences, but they're the ones that are probably not going to, you know, you made reference to your conservative friends who are tying this into the investigation of Hunter Biden or lack thereof and all of that, is that I would say that another key difference that may or may not convince any listener sort of on the other side of that issue is what is the motivation of asking someone to investigate or not, or asking them to stay out of an investigation? Is it to allow sort of proper separation of powers in the United States to operate? Was it a genuinely motivated effort to root out corruption in, you know, in Ukraine that might be infecting the Ukrainian government? Or is it to investigate somebody to try to smear one of your political rivals? And those things all might look kind of the same on paper, but behind the scenes, they're very different things. But it can be difficult to know with certainty or to prove with certainty what the motivation is, because that requires that you either have lots of involved information through maybe memos, emails, conversations, whistleblower reports, or, you know, you're trying to read people's minds and figure out what their motivations were in asking Ukraine to do one thing or another.
Hey, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Gene in Barrie. Good morning, Gene. Gene, are you with us?
If Trump didn't do anything wrong, why did they hide that tape that he made the call to the president of Ukraine?
Lisa Holmes, what do you think about that? They apparently put this
yeah.
tape on a transcript on a very in a very secure server.
So different from the others, right?
Right. Lisa, let me ask Lisa Holmes, what do you think about that?
Well, it's an interesting angle to all of this, right? As I mentioned in response to one of the earlier questions, it can be hard to sort of suss out what's happening in these kinds of things absent more information. But I think this is an important bit of information. Was the concerted effort to try to lock this down, prevent it from getting out, even though it was a relatively routine call between President Trump and a newly elected leader in another part of the world. So I do think that tells us something about what the people around the president thought of this conversation, perhaps. Yes.
Well, I got to say, it feels a little on the minor side to me. And tell me if you agree, Lisa, because this is a rare case in which the crime might be worse than the cover-up.
Well, I think that's a fair point, but in terms, again, and I think just the fact that Gene called in to ask that very question, as I said already, I'm a political scientist. Impeachment is mostly a political thing.
Yeah.
And if that little bit of information is what gets people like Gene to think, this smells fishier than I would have thought otherwise, then it's maybe a more important point to her than it is to you, and that's okay.
Sure, yeah. I saw, again, I quote conservative friends, one posted something, I think, on Facebook or something the other day, or maybe his blog, talking about the idea that what you see depends on where you stand.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that would be a political science kind of analysis, it seems, of the situation, although I do keep wanting to go back to the idea of sort of law and justice, et cetera. And maybe we've just are in a totally post-factual world, as some people claim, but can facts still raise their hand every now and then?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think perhaps we will see, right? That I think it's harder for facts to turn the tide, perhaps. But also, let's keep in mind, I think we're all also getting a lot of reminders of sort of the long, drawn-out process of the Watergate scandal, right? That public sentiment did not really turn on that until, in-depth investigation in Congress began and information started coming out. Now, one thing that is, of course, true is that we are in a much more partisan era right now, right, than we were back then. And we've got a more polarized media now than we did then. So, I was being interviewed about this last week, and the person interviewing me was essentially trying to get me to say ways in which this could work, this impeachment inquiry into President Trump could work out in a way that is not divisive. And I basically said, no, I think it's going to be divisive. This is basically going to be what it is. There are some people there are still some people in sort of the mushy middle between the two kind of warring sides who might be open to persuasion. But, by and large, we are not seeing much by way of cracks on the Trump supporters, at least in terms of sort of what they're saying publicly.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I think it's kind of too bad. I mean, to me, I've always thought a key part of the discourse, I understand that a big part of the discourse is opinion and is people's sentiments and their own life backgrounds and how those opinions get formed and all that, very important. But I also have felt like facts were important touchstones in the past, and they seem to be really getting swallowed up these days. It's kind of disturbing to me.
But. Well, it is. And one thing that I would also point out about this is that while this seems to be a particular kind of feature of the Trump administration, I think it's important to recognize that this predates Trump and it will post-date Trump. You know, regardless of how this works out, this problem that you're talking about will not go away one way or another once President Trump is no longer president.
Is it a strategy of certain types of politics, though?
What do you mean by that?
Well, I see a lot of people online, frankly, cheering Trump's lies.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I can't fully explain that. What I can say is that there are some theories, being worked on in my world, in the political science world, to try to explain this. Again, some of this has to do with the influence of a polarized media that on both sides that is capable of at times spinning things in ways that inform less and rile up more, for example.
Lisa Holmes, you know what? I knew we would get here. we got to cut it off because I'm at the end of this segment. But I so much appreciate you, and I'd love to have you back to delve a little more into the into this underlying philosophy about what are facts and how important are they. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And we are going to a CBS News break at the top of the hour. We'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Code, fashion-forward Tonya De Bellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back here for the second hour of this Monday morning show, and my guest is Tom Squitieri of Talk Media News. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, good morning, and happy Monday to you, Dave.
And to you as well. Oh boy, the president is not going to go down without a fight here, is he?
No, he's not, but that's his typical behavior. You know, we've seen that even before he was president. That's his style. Attack, 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 raise innuendo, never really complete the deal. Remember, Obama, birth certificate, how long he persisted on that. Then when it was proven he was wrong, he just pretended like he never did anything on it and moved on. Mm-hmm. That's what he's going to do here. We're going to go after the whistleblower. He's wrong. He's bad. He's a spy. We should, you know, what we do to spies. It's all aggressive. It's all diverting attention. It's all creating a different narrative. And he's in a jam now because it was his own words that he's fessed up to that started this.
So is Adam Schiff on the hook for treason?
You know, that's ridiculous. I mean, you talk about, he's already attacked him physically. He made fun of his neck or something like that.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
That didn't stick. You know, people looked at that and said, really? And so now he's accusing a member of Congress who's doing his constitutional duty of treason.
Yeah, I shouldn't laugh. I do tend to laugh sometimes because, I don't know, the alternative.
We would laugh at this if this was a movie.
Yeah, you know, the alternative.
That someone ridiculous was like saying these ridiculous things who's president of the United States. And you know, you and I discussed this, I think, on Friday. This is not a policy thing. You know, this is not disagreeing with whether you stay in the climate control treaty or not. That's a policy thing that you
right.
can disagree with. This is a question of using your office allegedly for personal gain when you're president of the United States.
Yeah.
And the Congress is oversight. That's part of the deal, you know, and that's the good part, one of the good parts of the deal. And Congress is in a good position now to exercise oversight because this is nothing to do with Mueller or anything else. This is something that came out and the president has admitted to it. And he's trying to say there's nothing wrong with it. That's not him for him to decide.
If President Trump's going to throw the T word treason around so loosely, we probably ought to review for folks. My recollection is, and I haven't looked it up in the last couple of days, but my earlier recollection is that it's a fairly narrow concept, legal concept, that and you have to be at war, and this is actually giving direct aid to enemies. I mean, it's really it is so far from what Adam Schiff is doing here, except I guess in the completely metaphorical mind of Donald Trump, who thinks that any of his critics are enemies of the American people. That's the way he describes it.
Well, let me give you a different version of that.
Okay.
The Pentagon, where I spend most of my time as a journalist these days,
yep.
has come out with their national defense strategy from a year or so ago,
mm-hmm.
and they identified the principal enemies of the United States as China and Russia, among
mm-hmm.
others.
Mm-hmm.
Russia. Hear that word, Russia?
Yeah,
so
I heard
if
you.
If you're giving aid and comfort to Russia, I would think that you would be more in line to be suggested as being treasonous behavior than one who's trying to find out if you gave aid and comfort to Russia.
Well, there is that.
How's that?
Yeah, I would say. In fact,
for those who are confused about what treason is, two words. Benedict Arnold.
Yeah, and that's plays up here because, of course, he was very active on Lake Champlain,
Green Mountain Boys.
Yeah, and all
like that.
Yeah, Tom. So I guess I'm sort of curious to how this will unfold in the coming weeks. I mean, the Congress is on recess, but some of the committees are working. What do you expect this week, next week, and give us a little roadmap here?
I'll try to, but let me just go to what you just said, which is interesting, and people should realize Congress is on recess, yet they still are going to have hearing this week, I believe, and next week.
Mm-hmm.
That is not that is not the usual behavior mode of Congress. When they're on recess, they are on recess. You know, they're back in their home districts.
Yeah.
So to have this, I think, based on my years of being here and what I've seen, is unusual and distinctive. Distinctive might be the better word than unusual. It's unusual, but I think it's distinctive because it means they want to get on this. They want to get moving on it. They want to stay focused on it because there is an election next year, and you know all the members of the House stand for re-election every 2 years. And so they want to get this thing going, and the narrow focus actually helps them.
Yeah, well, let me ask about that.
I'm sorry, I didn't answer your question. The roadmap, I think, is you're going to have a bunch of people coming up and talking to the committee, mm-hmm. and you're going to have subpoenas going out, and those subpoenas will probably wind up in some legal jousting. So while that's going on, you'll have witnesses come up to sort of focus first on this whole thing, what the president said in this call and what that means, as well as then the broader implications, the background, the backstory. Let's take it from, because, you know, let's just make it, pretend we're in the movies here. And Star Wars came out, you know, big deal. That was the big thing. And then they had what happened after Star Wars. Well, then they did a series of movies to show what happened before, you know, Luke Skywalker and all that, okay?
Yeah.
So we're going to be also in that mode now of what happened before this phone call in Ukraine, as well as perhaps the broader area of the geography of Russia, Ukraine, et cetera, to see where what led us to that moment.
Well, yeah, I think
that's
a
hunch. By the way, I want to make sure that's a hunch. I don't have the inside information on that. That's just a hunch.
Yeah, I get you. Well, I think that, and how do you think this will, I mean, will the House deliver articles of impeachment to the Senate, and when?
I can't even guess on that. You know, I don't know. I think they've been very careful about not giving any kind of thing. You know, sort of like we'll see where the inquiry goes, and that's the way they should do it.
Yeah, yeah, okay. You know, we left a jump ahead. If possible.
Well, we do. You know, I'm with you on this. Yeah. I could sit down and offer projections on this and that. You know, I will just say, you know, just now I'm reversing myself, I would say that I think that ideally the Democrats in the House would like to get this done before, you know, the voting starts next year in the caucuses, and that's February. So
yeah.
in New Hampshire. So if you look at that as a timetable, that's what, 3 months?
Sure, yeah.
We're talking about Christmas, holidays, end of the year stuff, so, you know. That's just me thinking, you know, because you want to have most of it underway before the vote starts, because, you know, it'll dominate coverage, and I don't know how many Democratic presidential candidates want that to be taking. Well, who knows, maybe they do, depending on the candidate.
Keep them out of the limelight for a couple more months.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Tom Scutieri, I really appreciate you joining us this morning, and it's always good talking with you. Let's do this again soon.
All right.
If you ask me, I want to talk about wildlife right now, because I saw a very interesting news release last week come out from a couple of green groups, and one of the things they were talking about, a Schuytzville Hill Wildlife Corridor, and we're going to find out what a wildlife corridor is. And what we're doing, I'll just read a little bit here. The Route 100 Scenic Byway connects visitors and residents to some of Vermont's most beautiful landscapes. The Scenic Byway, of course, right here in our neighborhood, just within a half a mile, I guess it is, of WDEV studio here in Waterbury. It also bisects a forested landscape that animals such as bear, moose, and bobcat need to thrive. Concern for the future of these animals led a partnership of community members, municipalities, conservation groups, and state agencies to protect the last remaining forested corridor connecting the Green Mountains and the Worcester Range. And so, again, folks, this is all our local geography right around here. The Schuytzville Hill Wildlife Corridor crosses Route 100 on the Waterbury-Stowe line and is the only viable connection between the Green Mountains and the Worcester Range. It is one of the five most important wildlife crossings in the state and a critical part of an international network of connected forest habitats in the Northeast. And the three of the partnership's members, the Stowe Land Trust, the Nature Conservancy, and the Vermont Land Trust, along with dedicated community members, have raised $500,000 to cover the cost of permanently protecting 3 to 5 key properties in this critical area. So we are getting easements, we're buying up some property, we're figuring out a way to make sure that wildlife can traverse what is a heavily traveled area, the Route 100 corridor. That's a human corridor. And how do these two cross each other? We're going to learn in the next 40 minutes or so here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. My guests are Jim Shallow of the Nature Conservancy, Kristen Sharpless of the Stowe Land Trust, and Bob Heiser of the Vermont Land Trust, all of whom have been intimately involved in this project. And so I guess just I'm going to pick out of the hat here sort of and start with Jim Shallow and get you to explain to us a little bit about what are we doing here.
Yeah, thanks, Dave, and thanks for having us in today. Schuylkill Hill is a really important area here in Vermont and regionally because, you know, we're seeing wildlife beginning to shift their ranges in response to climate change. In fact, we've seen that, in general, wildlife ranges are shifting northward by about 11 miles each decade, and they're also moving in elevation up around 30 feet each decade as well. So we need to have that the opportunity for those animals to move across the landscape as their ranges shift. And so places like Schuylkill that connect these big forest blocks like Mount Mansfield and the Worcester Mountains are really critical to allow those animals to move out of those big blocks across the landscape and then ultimately, if they have to, move up to Canada. Closer. Thank you.
A little closer to the mic so we can cut the echo down just a bit here. Let me also ask you, in terms of the, I mean, I have it right that one of the big barriers here is the actual state highway, right?
That's right. Route 100 goes right up through the middle of this corridor, so it swoops down this this area, kind of swoops down out of the Green Mountains, kind of over by Waterbury Reservoir, and then across over to through what we call Schuylkill, right along the Waterbury and Stowe town line. So yeah, Route 100 goes right up through the middle of it. And as we know, a lot of times wildlife and roads don't mix very well. So what we're trying to do is figure out ways to both create a forested corridor through this area so that animals feel safe and can move through there, but also ultimately begin to think about how we can best facilitate those animals to move across the road.
And what are the key techniques here? Are we thinking tunnels, bridges?
So in many places here in Vermont, what we're looking at when we're thinking about road crossings is underneath the road, you know, because many of our roads cross over our rivers and we have, small streams that go under those roads through culverts. And all of those present opportunities for allowing wildlife to move under the road. Here in Schuylkill, there aren't a lot of opportunities to go under the road because the road is right down on the bedrock. So ultimately, we'll need to be thinking about how we can find ways, whether it's some people have raised the idea of a bridge. But before we can even have those conversations, we need to know that we have protected land on both sides of the road in order to allow those animals to have a place to go when they cross the road.
I guess that would be an important thing. And then because you're going to want to essentially manage the animals, I don't want to say herd them, but get them into the right spots across the road so that...
Yeah, absolutely. You want to be guiding the animals into a place that's safe to cross. But if we don't have protected land on either side of the road, then you can build a bridge to nowhere.
Yeah, that would not be a good project, a bridge to nowhere. Bob Heiser, actually, tell me, you are with the Vermont Land Trust's, I believe the Lake Champlain chapter, or you're the regional director of the Champlain Valley section of the Vermont Land Trust, and tell us a little bit about the sort of deal or whatever you want to call it between the groups involved here and who's doing what.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having us, and we're excited to be able to tell even more community members in the area about the importance of this place. So thank you. So there are many partners working together. First of all, the local groups, Stowe Land Trust, and then the conservation commissions in both Stowe and Waterbury have really been leaders in bringing this whole thing forward. So they've played a very instrumental role. And then there's the conservation organizations that have joined in to see if we can help coordinate the effort to do a lot of prioritization as to where we should focus our efforts, even within this corridor, to emphasize where the most important lands are for connecting the Mount Mansfield block of the Green Mountains to the Worcester Range. So we've been at Vermont Land Trust working with several landowners over the last year or so to permanently conserve their land and make sure that it will always be part of this critical corridor and really protecting their own land, but being part of something really a lot bigger.
Tell me, if I were to pull the lens back on the map here, how big a region? It looks like I saw the word international. That implies it extends up into Canada of the wildlife range we're looking at here.
Yeah, so it's important on very three different levels at least. First, locally, it's very important to the local communities. And then secondly, on a statewide level, it's connecting these big blocks of land from the Mount Mansfield side on the west and the Worcesters on the east. And then internationally, connecting land from the west in the Adirondacks all the way up through Nova Scotia. And this little area in the on the Waterbury-Stowe line is really a connector of all those larger blocks of forest land.
And when you say this small local area here, how unique is this focal point in that overall map that extends from the Adirondacks to Nova Scotia?
Yeah, so one of the things that kind of was the genesis of the focus on this area was a study done about 10 years ago called Critical Paths. And this was looking at key wildlife crossings in the northern part of Vermont. And the National Wildlife Federation hired a private consultant to do a study of the most critical crossings in the area. And Jesse Moore, who was that biologist, said that this crossing was irreplaceable, was his word. So it's really one of the five most important crossings in the state.
That's impressive. I mean, I think folks around here ought to be aware of what's right here in their own community, and so I'm glad to be helping to get the word out. Kristen Sharpless is executive director of the Stowe Land Trust, one of the groups involved in this effort. And Kristen joins us on the phone from Stowe this morning. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having us with you.
And what does a group like the Stowe Land Trust do to contribute to a project like this?
Sure. So Stowe Land Trust is a local land conservation organization. We've been working to protect productive farm and forest land that's important for recreation and scenic values and in our community for over three decades. And this opportunity to work on conserving the wildlife corridor is really a pretty unique one for us. Most of the work that we've done to date has been within the Stowe town boundary. But what we've really recognized with the corridor is that wildlife habitat that's important to our community doesn't always follow or pay attention to those town boundaries or political boundaries.
Yeah.
And so it was really important for us to partner with the Vermont Land Trust and the Nature Conservancy and the Waterbury Conservation Commission and the others that Jim and Bob have mentioned have been working on this effort to play a role. Not only in helping to protect important land, but also in terms of community education and outreach. So we've been involved and worked pretty closely with the Waterbury Conservation Commission for going on 10 years now to hold various speaker events or talks, outings that just help make our local communities aware of this really amazing place that we do have right in our backyards, and what we all can be doing to help protect it.
Wow, yeah. Hey, I wanted to ask one question, which before I forget, and we have a couple of minutes to go to our bottom of the hour break. We'll continue our conversation afterward. But I wanted to squeeze, just while I'm thinking of it, I saw in the, I think in the statement that was issued last week that there was discussion about how the wildlife crossing had moved 11 miles north due to climate change. Is that right, Jim Shallow?
Yes. So their ranges, continentally, we're seeing wildlife ranges shift northward by 11 miles each decade. But they're also moving north or upward in elevation 30 feet as well. So we need to find these places that, you know, will allow that movement to happen. And as Bob was saying, this is a critical link between Vermont and up into Canada. So if we lose this link, we're going to cut those that movement off in the future.
And this leads me to this question, which is, so if we build the build these links here now, what happens in 10 years when they are 11 miles farther north that are needed?
So, that's a really good question. And so what we need to do is have this landscape that is allowing wildlife to move. So the wildlife that we may have in Vermont in the future may be very different from what we have here today. And so it's really important to have places where wildlife can move in as ranges shift northward, and that the other, you know, or persist in place. So it's important to have that structure in place that allows them to be here or for the new stuff to move into Vermont.
Bob Heiser of the Vermont Land Trust, I wonder, road frontage has to be a huge issue. You know, getting a property owner, oftentimes the most valuable real estate in town is right along the state highway. And you're basically looking for folks to give away that value, or at least some of it, right?
Yeah, you know, we're working in all areas of the corridor, but you're right. That is the most important place.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we actually do need to go to a break at the bottom of the hour. Let's talk about this afterward. Stay with us, folks. I think this is a fascinating conversation about wildlife getting around our good old state of Vermont here. We'll be back.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toton Code, Fashion Forward, Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back continuing our conversation about the Schuytzville Wildlife Corridor right here in the Waterbury Stowe area. Route 100 between Waterbury and Stowe, what we think of now is a nice paved road. You can drive up and visit all the businesses along the side of the road there between Waterbury and Stowe and get your chocolates at Lake Champlain. Well, I shouldn't start advertising for individual businesses, but, you know, it's a really nice drive, and there's a lot going on this road. Probably built, I don't know, what, a couple hundred, 250 years ago, or maybe it started as, we were talking on a break, maybe possibly as an Indian trail, you know, a way to just go up the river in the valley here to get from one settlement to the next, and that's pretty much what it still is now, even though it's paved and people are doing 60 where it's supposed to be 50 and whatever, you know. And I guess the one question I have for you is, we're sort of nobody thought back in those days about trying to make sure the wildlife could get around, or would this road interfere with them. Our thinking has changed as of when? 1990, Jim?
Yeah, it's been a fairly recent awareness that has grown. So think about it this way. When we built the road, there was much less development in the forests of Vermont, right? So animals had a lot of places to move around, even if there was a road here. Mm-hmm. But as more and more, you know, as we've cleared more land, we've developed more places along this corridor, these little pinch points become even more important. And so I think we're becoming more and more aware of both the importance of these crossings, but also in a way, this is kind of like us adapting to climate change, us being humans. We're beginning to see the importance of these areas, but also, you know, we're making our culverts larger, we're making larger bridges over our roads to allow for bigger flood precipitation. And those, when we're doing that, it provides us with an opportunity to allow wildlife, you know, create opportunities for wildlife to be able to move under our roads. So they're adapting, but we also have to adapt at the same time.
And Kristen Sharpless of the Stowe Land Trust, I usually think of an outfit like a town land trust preserving high elevation, you know, open grassy meadows on a mountainside somewhere where people can run around and sing the sound of music or something. Especially the Stowe Land Trust, pardon me, but I, you know, and yet here we are actually starting to focus on very valuable real estate right along the roadsides. Is that fair?
Right. Yes. Well, we definitely at Stowe Land Trust, I think, are very focused on providing public access and opportunities for people to use and enjoy the land. So whether that's Trapp Family Lodge or Katy Hill Forest, certainly for us, a lot of the work that we do has a recreation and public access bent. And with the corridor, that is different. So in this case, we're really prioritizing and focusing on ensuring that the forest and the habitat is there for the animals to move through. And that doesn't necessarily mean that's incompatible with people also certainly living in the landscape, because this is, you know, there are hundreds of properties and homes in this area, so we're all sharing space with wildlife, but the purpose of protecting the land is much more about animal movement than access for people, and that is a bit different for Stowe Land Trust in particular in terms of the work that we do.
It's really interesting. Of course, the Vermont Land Trust is sort of Stowe Land Trust writ large, and Bob Heiser of the Vermont Land Trust is here as well. And I just wonder if this is going to be an iterative process, let's say in 11 years, which it seems to be the interval at, in a decade, animals moving 11 miles north, wildlife moving 11 miles north because of climate change. Are we going to be worried about what we built along the roadsides in 2019, thinking, okay, we got a wildlife corridor, we have some development here, we got another wildlife corridor, more development. Will those patterns be upended by the move that we might have to make in 2030?
Yeah, I think our idea and our challenge right now is trying to not so much predict exactly how things are going to change, but just make sure that we have a connected landscape so that there's an avenue for things to change and be connected. So as these species and populations need to be able to move across the landscape, we know right now that this is a pinch point. And if we lose this pinch point, there will be a lot fewer avenues for these species to change over time. And so if we can make sure that we maintain this connectivity, we will be increasing the ways things can move forward in the future.
Folks, our call-in numbers are 244-1777 here in the local Waterbury area, 1-877-291-8255. And if you have any questions about this effort to make sure there's a good working wildlife corridor between the Green Mountains and the Worcester Range, right across the human corridor known as Route 100 between Waterbury and Stowe, give us a call. Let us know what you're thinking about this, or what you know. Let us know what makes you curious about it. And I think there's a fascinating new thinking going on here about the relationship between humans and the wildlife in our environment, and might require humans somehow becoming, I don't know, more nimble or something, if that's a good way to describe it. Jim, what do you think?
Yeah, Dave, I think I just want to build on one of the things Bob was saying, is that another way to think about this is we're trying to protect the stage here. So think about it like the best analogy I've seen is like, if you want to have a robust baseball, you want to make sure that Fenway Park remains there. The player's going to come and go, but if we don't keep Fenway Park in place, we won't have a place to play baseball.
Yeah.
So think about it that way. We're trying to protect the stage where life can adapt and move, and we know things are going to be changing. But at TNC, the Nature Conservancy, we're a global organization. We've mapped out where these resilient lands are going to be going forward based on a lot of conditions. And this area is also one that is, we've seen in our mapping show up as a place that's going to be resilient into the future. So we're building on a place that we know will stay in place and will allow animals and wildlife and other life to adjust in a changing climate.
So if this particular area between Waterbury and Stowe is, I think we might describe it as one of the five most important pinch points in the state. Is that right? Give us the list. What are the other four? Bob, do you know?
Not offhand. I know Fish and Wildlife has a handful that they consider the highest priority, and they've definitely let us know that this is one of them. And I can't rattle off the other four. But
yeah, so some of those are up north along the Canadian border. Mm-hmm. That Cold Hollow to Canada region is a critical area that needs to be maintained if we're going to allow things to move northward into Canada. Mm-hmm. Another area is along Route 22 down in the southern Lake Champlain Basin. Where, you know, you're coming out of the Green Mountains, and that's our prime corridor to get over into the Adirondacks is yeah. moving through New Haven area there, where the Nature Conservancy has a big preserve there. But Route 22 cuts right across it, so we want to make sure that we're preserving that area. Also along Route 7 in Pittsford is another critical area. If you know sort of that area, there's a, you know, a forested connection that kind of gets us over into that same sort of lower Champlain Basin area. So those are a few that people should be thinking about when they think about those pinch points in Vermont.
Yeah, and these pinch points largely, again, created because roads were built there. Is that fair?
Roads and human settlement.
Yeah.
Right? So along the roads comes human settlement.
Sure,
so yeah, we have a very robust road network here in Vermont and New England, and so we're trying to accommodate both the ability for humans to move through our landscape, and now we want to make sure that as we do that, that we're thinking as we upgrade that system of roads, that we're allowing for wildlife to be able to move across those.
And Bob, tell me in terms of the wildlife biology here, or either one of you, whoever wants to take a swing at this one, I would gather that we're talking about deer and bobcats and bear and moose and a whole range of different animals here, and that they're going to adapt at different rates to changing climate. So that when we talk about this move northward 11 miles in a decade, that's got to be an average, right? I mean,
yes, very much. And that's a great question. And in many ways, those large animals are the easiest way to envision this, but it is life at every level that needs to be able to migrate within a span of a year, within a span of a breeding season, and within a span of lifetimes. So we're definitely interested in these large mammals, but we're also interested in a lot of other types of plants and animals that need to migrate as the climate changes.
What are some of the smaller animals I'm missing here? I mean, I can guess, but give me some examples.
Yeah, I mean, we can be talking about salamanders and frogs, or mm-hmm. we can be talking about birds that are going to be nesting in certain types of habitats, and that will shift over time. And so they need to have those connected habitats to be able to maintain their ranges as well.
That's really interesting. Now, I think of salamanders and frogs, and sadly enough, you know, some instances where you hear about a whole mass of frogs crossing a road, and that doesn't work very well with traffic, et cetera. So how do the frogs know where to? I mean, I guess eventually they're going to go down in the culvert and cross there. But how do they? I mean, do frogs have that level of adaptability?
Sure. So we've seen over in Moncton where the Agency of Transportation has put in a salamander, an amphibian crossing under the road over there.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you know, there's sort of fencing that you can put along off the road to guide those animals. You know, they're moving along in the leaf litter and everything in the fall. In the spring. And what's happening is they're moving out of the uplands where they've spent the winter. They're headed down to the wetlands where they're going to mate and, you know, make the next generation.
Yep.
And they've got one thing on their mind at that point, and they're moving towards it. And so if you can just sort of prevent, you know, provide a little bit of barrier leading up to that crossing, and then provide the structure underneath the road, it works really well. And we've seen that in Moncton, and we're seeing it in other places as well.
So the frogs just have to look on Google Maps and they know. No.
They look for road signs, yeah.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Bob?
I just wanted to acknowledge that, how important Route 100 is to this entire conversation, but also we've kind of evolved in our thinking of thinking about this as much more of a connectivity issue, that we have these two big blocks of state land on the east and the west, and Stowe Village on the north and Waterbury Village on the south. And in between, we still have connected forest land, and we do need to pay attention to Route 100. But also, as that forest land gets developed, we lose connectivity just from one place to another, even if Route 100 were not in the middle. So we're thinking about this much more as this band of forest land as a corridor. And we know we have to be thinking about this Route 100 crossing issue, but also about that existing forest land.
So the map is clearly bigger than just a stretch across a state highway, for
that's
sure.
That's right, yeah. Exactly.
That's very interesting. And let me bring in the more of the human element here. And I wanted to ask Kristen Sharpless about the role of a community, because obviously you're with the Stowe Land Trust, and I gather, I mean, I'm just guessing here, but you go to meetings up there in Stowe and folks turn out and you say to them, listen, we're trying to raise money to do this work along Vermont Route 100 to create this wildlife corridor. And what should community members be thinking about, and when they weigh, you know, a request for essentially a charitable contribution against all the other requests for charitable contributions? How does this fit in the picture of kind of philanthropy?
Sure. So I would say, you know, the fundraising that we have done as part of this initial catalyst effort of land protection in the corridor, which is really kind of a, we hope will be a jumping off point for further work, has involved a lot of conversations with individuals, more than big community broad fundraising. And in those conversations, what we've really, I think, has spoken to the folks who have made early investments in and contributions to helping make this land protection work happen is that this is really a unique and really important area. So if you care about wildlife, you're concerned about the impacts of climate change and other stresses on our wildlife and biodiversity here in Vermont, this is a really concrete, and for us here in the Stowe-Waterbury area, local, direct way to make a difference by helping to ensure that the corridor is secure and stays open for animal movement. We're able to act locally and really have a global or at least international impact and effect. And you don't get a lot of opportunities like that in conservation. We do a lot as a local land trust of really exciting community work to provide great places for our community to enjoy, and local farms, and but you don't always get that really big scale kind of tiered impact. And I think that's been very exciting to the folks who have made early contributions to this effort, and probably will continue to be compelling.
Yeah, it does kind of tickle the imagination when you think of this one locale here in this section of, I guess, Waterbury or Stowe called Schutzville, that it's such a linchpin that in a larger region. That's fascinating. Yeah. And it sounds like, I mean, I think our listeners by now, I hope I've gotten the idea of what you all are up to. Let's talk a little bit about where we are in the process. You've been raising some funds, holding some local events, and how much have you raised? Have you actually gotten shovels in the ground yet, Bob Heiser?
Yeah, great question. So we have been incredibly fortunate to reach our $500,000 fundraising goal through the generosity of many donors. And we've actually made some first steps at successes in conservation in the corridor, which is also great. There are three projects we've completed already as far as conservation in the corridor, and they was add up to over 350 acres. And that they range from Chris Curtis and Terry Swenson conserving 63 acres of their land on North Hill, which is right in the middle of the corridor. The Nature Conservancy purchased 10 acres right on Route 100 from the Lackey family. And then on the west side of the corridor, the Smeltzers, Eric and Dale Smeltzer, donated a conservation easement on almost 300 acres. So already we're seeing successes there, and really generous landowners either donating or donating a portion of the value of those conservation efforts. And then I can pass it off to Kristen just to talk about a project they're working on that'll add to that conservation number in the corridor soon.
Kristen?
Sure. So in addition to those three exciting projects, the Stowe Land Trust has been working with the Trust for Public Land on a conservation effort along the Worcester Range that will add almost 2,000 acres of forest land to the C.C. Putnam State Forest. And most of that land is actually over on the other side in Worcester and Middlesex, but there's 109 acres in Stowe Hollow owned by Charlie and Gibby Berry that will be added to the state forest and also happens to fall within the wildlife corridor. So there's a little bit of overlap there, and that project is likely to be complete this fall.
Wow. So several moving pieces here that are and is there going to be more fundraising needed, more money beyond the $500,000, Bob Heiser?
You know, right now we have some of that funding left to work on an additional project or two, which we're in the process of doing. I think this effort has done exactly what we were hoping to do, and that is kind of to get early success and to hopefully inspire others to conserve their land as well. And we're also doing other things in the community to educate folks about the importance of the corridor so that they're able to manage their land in a way that's more accommodating to wildlife moving through. And we do have some events coming up. In fact, just yesterday we had a workshop hosted by local communities, Enterprises, the Makersphere in Waterbury is hosting a camera contest, and you can go to their website at makersphere.com and get in on a contest that'll help get photos in the corridor. And we're also going to be hosting a presentation by Andrea Shortsleeve from Fish and Wildlife Department on managing your land for wildlife. So those folks that want to take care of their land in the corridor and improve the wildlife habitat there on October 15th from 7 to 8 at the Green Mountain Club, we're going to be hosting a talk on that. So trying to help people protect this corridor in a variety of ways.
Wow. What are one or two key things a landowner can do to make their property more hospitable to wildlife? Jim?
Sure. A couple things. If they have forest land, you know, in backwood lots, thinking about how they can manage that in a way that will benefit wildlife. You know, some things are, you know, as simple as leaving brush piles around in the woods or, you know, keeping your dogs near the house as opposed to running around in the woods when wildlife might be moving through. So things like that. But, you know, I would encourage people to reach out to Fish and Wildlife. Andrea Shortsleeves has a list of things that landowners can do to make their lands helpful for wildlife. And I'm also really happy that we're running down. And we have all of these events have been supported by other funders, including the High Meadows Fund, which is supporting efforts to put game cameras out in the wildlife corridor. And we'll be sharing the results of that with the community as that information comes out.
Wow, that sounds like fun. I gather that'll be up on the web somewhere too, right? And folks can watch the bears and the deer and the salamanders and whatever making their way through the woods and across this land. And boy, I just it's terrific work here, folks. I congratulate you on the effort so far, and I wish you luck in the coming years with this because it just seems like a really, really good cause. I'm glad to give it a little publicity here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. I want to thank my guests very much, Jim Shallow of the Nature Conservancy and Bob Heiser of the Vermont Land Trust, Kristen Sharpless, Executive Director of the Stowe Land Trust. Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Dave.
That's about it for the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. Don't forget to stay tuned now for Bill Sayer, Common Sense Radio, and we'll be back with another edition of our program tomorrow morning a little bit after 9 o'clock. Have a great day, everybody.